Before we get started with today's podcast, we'd like to ask returning listeners to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcast platform, iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you really enjoy it, share a link to this podcast with friends or family who would enjoy hearing our weekly discussions about basketball and basketball culture. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the 19.9 podcast. I'm Aaron Meyer, the host of today's show. Our guest today is Mike Klinzing, the founder and executive director of Head Start Basketball. He's a licensed USA basketball youth development coach and a Positive Coaching Alliance certified trainer. Mike loves the game of basketball, and he always has. When you hear stories about the kid who is always playing basketball in the dark, in the snow, in the living room, that was Mike. He kept a journal of all his practice session when he was a young player and pushed himself to the brink. Mike believes young players will have more fun when they can play the game and play it the right way. Oh, his side gig is the host of the Hoopheads podcast, which covers a wide range of basketball topics relevant to coaches, players, and parents. Listen in for interviews with personalities from across the basketball landscape. Their lineup of podcast guests include some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from the grassroots to the NBA. We get to be on the podcast, so I'm glad to say that maybe I'm a top mind. I've never been called that before.
That's all right, man. You're in.
I'm gonna take that and run with it. Hey, getting started tonight, we always like to start with your origin story. So just how you fell in love with the game. So we heard a little bit in the intro there about how you approached getting better at the game. But I'm just curious, what brought you to the game of basketball to begin with?
Man, from the time I was a little kid, I'm talking before times that I can even remember. There's pictures of me, family photos in the album of me with the little Nerf basket and my dad holding up a little tiny metal rim. And me holding the ball and throwing it in when I was probably, 13, 14 months old, something like that. Gosh. So I think my dad got me started early. He wasn't necessarily, my dad played hoops through like 10th grade in high school. And then I think he got cut as a 10th grader. And then he switched over and became a runner. But he always was a guy that just wanted me to be involved in sports. And so I was given an opportunity to try out just about everything. I mean, I think other than maybe soccer was the one thing that for whatever reason, I just never got into it, never really tried it, but just about anything else. If you put a ball in front of me, I was willing to get out there and at least give it a shot. And so I played some baseball as a kid, again, talking when I was younger, played a lot of backyard football, played a ton of basketball as a young kid, spent so much time on my driveway. And I just think that over the course of time of all the sports that I played, for some reason, basketball just kept coming back to me. And I think part of that was, and I've heard people say this to me numerous times, that the ability to be able to go out on your own and practice and get better. I didn't need somebody to throw pitches to me. I didn't need somebody to go and throw passes to as the quarterback. It was just something that I could go out, I could pick up my ball, and any time that I wanted to go out and shoot, I could just go out to the driveway and I could shoot. And I think that ability to just be on my own. And I remember, just like everybody else, you pretended you were your favorite players back in the day. Put 10 seconds on the clock.
Who were you pretending to be?
Dr. J. Okay. So I was born in 1970.
Okay.
So when Dr. J, I remember, I have vague recollections of the 77 NBA Finals, which was on tape delay, isn't that crazy?
Those
games would come on at like 11:30. So I don't remember watching much of that, but I remember just enough of Dr. J. And I always gravitated towards guys that could do things that I physically could never do. So I was not a high flyer. I was not a runner, a jumper. I was a guy that was ground bound. And so as a kid, it's funny, I always grew up disliking Larry Bird, because Larry Bird was probably a guy who was closer to the type of player that I could have been. I love Magic. I love Larry. I love Dr. J. And then obviously I love Jordan as time went on, But Dr. J was my guy when I was a real young kid. Mm. And so I can remember being out on the court, you know, in my driveway and just counting down and trying to be Dr. J. And my dad was one of those guys that he was, I guess, in some ways ahead of his time, because we always had a lower basket at my house. And obviously today you have the fancy goals you go out and buy.
The Goalrilla.
Right. That are, you know, $2,000. My dad, I had a wooden pole. I had two sets of U-clamps.
Oh my gosh.
And I had a plywood fan backboard that my dad had cut out with his, you know, jigsaw and bolted all that together. But he was at least smart enough to get me started on a basket that was, you know, was out when I was in first grade, my basket was probably 7 feet high.
Yeah.
And then slowly as I grew up, it got a little higher. And I think that's what helped me to become a good shooter. But it also, in a lot of ways, helped me to get up and be able to, like, I could throw down some dunks occasionally because the basket was, you know, because the basket was so low, or I could adjust it and move it down. So that was nice. So I remember being Dr. J. I remember loving Converse shoes back in the day, the Dr. J All-Stars. That was the first pair of real basketball shoes that I ever had that I played inside with, that I didn't wear around, you know, out. I didn't wear them into the gym.
Right.
That was the first pair I really had. And of course, just like everybody from my era, I had started out with some Chuck Taylors, and then I had some other kind of generic tennis shoes. But I think it was like sixth or seventh grade when I got that first pair of leather Dr. J's, and man, that was it for me. That was the thing.
Shoes have become such a big part of the culture, but even then, you're right. Like there was a big emphasis on you wore your shoe, did not wear your shoes like out of the gym. Like you take them off, you put them in your bag, like you take care of them. And I think that because you didn't have as many, like you might only have a pair of shoes for the season. So you better be taking care of those puppies, because
absolutely,
you wear them out, then you might not be getting another pair.
So I got a good story for that. So I spent a lot of time from age probably, I mean, I was on the driveway, which is obviously cement, but I'm out just in front of my house. But then as I got a little bit older, I'd say probably 13 or 14, I started to go down to the courts in the city where I live, which were probably about, I don't know, maybe a half mile away from where I live. And so I would ride my bike and I'd go down to these courts. And when it came to shoes, back in that time, to your point, like you had one pair of shoes that you used and that you played in all the time. It's not like I'm trading out a pair every night.
Yeah.
And of course, you're playing on the blacktop. Those things wear out a lot faster. So I don't know if you even remember. Do you remember shoe goo? You ever heard of shoe goo?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
All right. So shoe goo, I used to, and I got this again from my dad who used it on his running shoes, but it was just this big tube. For people who don't know what it is, it was just this tube of, like, I don't know, like silicone rubber or something. Knows, you just squeeze this tube out onto the bottom of your shoe and then try to smooth it out into the shape of the sole that was existing. And I mean, I went through so many tubes of that stuff just wearing it out, because again, you only had one pair of shoes, and those things had to last.
Yep.
Our kids today don't know how good they have.
No, I know. Yeah.
12 pairs of shoes and everything else is crazy.
Yeah. It's the same thing. So I'm curious. We talked even when we were on your podcast about playground basketball. And my question to you is, how do you bring elements of that into what you do now? So you train students too. And I think that we hit on it a little bit, and I'm pretty passionate about finding ways to bring some of the elements of the playground game, even into however students or kids learn how to play today, because I think there's something that they'll miss if they don't get parts of that. So I'm curious how you approach it, or if you encourage them to play outside, or where, how you take it.
I think it's hard to duplicate the experience that I had as a kid. You just don't, the system is not set up to be able to do that. When you think about playing with guys who are older than you, when you think about guys who are playing that are, you know, I was 13, 14 years old. I was playing with high school kids, or playing with college players, playing with adults. And even though some of those players may not have been the greatest players out there, they're still bigger, faster, stronger than you. And I think that makes you better. And as you said, today's kids just don't, they just don't play in the same way, because they're always playing against kids their own age. So how do you incorporate that? Excuse me, Aaron. How do you incorporate that into what you do or what I do today? So there's a couple things. One, I think so much of what kids do today is scripted and controlled by adults. So one of the things that I try to do, like with our camps, for example, we'll have teams, but those teams won't have a coach for their team. And so we'll kind of let the kids figure it out. We'll have a coach at the basket that will referee and kind of monitor a half court game, a 3-on-3 or 4-on-4, whatever it ends up being. But we'll kind of let the kids, okay, you guys kind of figure it out and try to go ahead and play. I think kids just don't get the opportunity to have free play in the same way that kids did in the past. So I think just giving them free play and having them have an opportunity to work things out themselves and figure out, pick the teams, being able to just decide, okay, who's going to sit out? Like, I don't try to dictate that. I'm like, you guys got five players. It's 3-on-3. Figure out who's sitting out first, who's sitting out second. I'm not going to tell you how to do that. And a lot of times kids will look at you like, oh my gosh, like we've never had to do this. Somebody's always told us, I go in the game now and I go out of the game now. And so I think those are some of the things that you can do just from an organizational standpoint. And then I think within the game, to me, one of the most important things that we can do as coaches is to allow our kids the freedom to make mistakes and to experiment. Because I think it's almost counterintuitive in that as coaches, a lot of times we want to see things, we want to fix them, we want to correct them. We want to say, okay, here's what you did wrong. This is what you should do. And when I think about how I learned the game, I don't remember having coaches all the time around me, correcting me, telling me what to do. I learned how to become a good one-on-one player by playing against a buddy of mine who lived like 2 miles away from me. We would ride our bikes to each other's houses. And then we'd play one-on-one to 100 without, you know, there was nobody there telling us, hey, you know, you got to make this jab step right here and then, you know, rip it through and then go to your right. It was like, look, I got to figure out how to beat this kid. So I got to figure out some moves. So it's like, I got to figure it out for myself. And I think so often today we take that ability to figure it out away from kids. We want to kind of hand it to them and say, hey, here's what you should do. But we all know when you think about being an educator yourself, when kids experience it for themselves and they have to figure it out, they internalize that learning a lot better than when somebody's just telling them. So I try to provide that kind of freedom to kids when I'm coaching them, in that you want them to be free to be able to try stuff and you want them to be able to expand what it is that they do out on the court. Because that's something that, again, I was doing in pickup games or I was doing on the driveway. I was trying stuff. I was saying, okay, here's a game where everybody's a lot better than me. So maybe what I have to do here is just figure out how can I play defense well enough to stay on the floor with this team and get the ball moving to the guys who are better than me.
Yeah.
Or conversely, I'm playing with guys who are not as good as me. Now maybe I'm only going to drive to my left, or I'm only going to work on my jumper, or I'm only going to take shots in the key or things like that. And I think when kids today so often just play with coaches and parents and scoreboards and people watching, they only tend to do what they're already good at because they're being judged. And I don't remember being judged other than by the people who are my teammates are like, well, this kid isn't doing what he's supposed to do. We're not picking him up for the next, him up for the next game, you know? So you kind of got to figure that out. So I think as a coach, it's really important to provide your players with an opportunity to try stuff and not play afraid. I mean, we've all seen games and teams and coaches and players where you can tell a kid checks into the game and he's scared to death to even try to do anything. And then he makes one mistake and he gets pulled out. Well, that kid's never going to have an opportunity to really get better or improve themselves. And I'm talking about that could be a high school player, but that could go down to second or third grade, where those kids just need opportunities to play and try stuff and fall in love with the game. And then when you fall in love with the game, that's really, like, you know, Aaron, that's how you get better.
Yeah. I love that. It sounds like a process of discovery, and as an educator, that is something, like, you give them the opportunity to make the mistakes and there to pick them up when they fall, rather than trying to help them avoid every single, you know, failure or mistake. 'Cause there's so much growth that happens in those moments as well.
Sometimes it feels like it's hard to do that. I mean, as an educator, it's hard to do that. And as a coach, it's hard to do that, because I think the perception sometimes is if you're standing on the sideline or you're standing in front of the classroom and you're just facilitating, or you're allowing things to go on, you're allowing kids to make mistakes or in the classroom, you're letting them discover or figure out something on their own. They're going to struggle with that a lot more than they are if you're up there spoon feeding it to them.
Yeah.
But you have to, I think, as a coach, you have to kind of get over that mentality and accept that when you give those players or your students as a teacher, when you give them more control over things, eventually it leads to better results. But it's hard. It's hard sometimes as a coach to stand on the sideline and not want to micromanage everything. It's hard to do that as a teacher.
For sure.
But I think ultimately what happens is when you do, the results may look messier, especially at the beginning, but I think the learning translates better when you allow kids to discover things on their own and figure it out on their own. One of the other things that goes along with that is, and this is something that I never did as a young coach, is I coach a lot more now with questions like, hey, what did you see right there? Or, hey, why did you make that play? Or what were your other alternatives? And instead of That's me good. Saying, well, look, you shouldn't have passed it there. You should have passed it over here. You ask them, hey, why did you pass it there? And then they kind of got to go back and think about it. And sometimes, especially with kids who are new to being coached that way, they'll say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. You know. But then eventually, as you get them trained, they'll start to figure out and think about, well, why did I do that? And they'll start to remember and be able to process it. And then that gets them thinking the game and again, helps them to learn a lot more.
Yeah. It's so funny because, you know, as an older player now, it just sometimes is almost awkward, like how much you know about the game, but how little you can do anymore. So, but it feels great to coach because then you can maybe get them to that point faster, or like you said, just kind of light the path ahead of them just a little bit. And you almost want to just put it out of reach so that they see where they're going, but not necessarily the answer. I think that's a great way to approach it. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about something that has had to be kind of crazy and scary. And I always love hearing these stories, but, you went and played D1 basketball at Kent State. And I just wanted to ask, what was the recruitment like? And you, you know, what advice would you offer to current players? Cause you're still in that role of having guys who are, you know, developing into D1 players or college basketball players. So I'm just curious, like, what was it like for you? And then how has it changed, and what would you even tell a kid now that was being recruited?
Absolutely. So let me say this. First of all, I don't think my recruitment, once I tell you the story, I'm not sure how relevant anything that I did. I can give you a lot of things that I did wrong during my recruitment. Nice. Huh? Plus, I think a lot of what happened to me is just different because of the way that recruiting is done today. But the advice that I give to players who are trying to be recruited, I'll pull that from all the great guests that we've had on our podcast and just kind of aggregate that into some advice. But I'll tell you my story first, and then we'll go and talk about some things that I've learned from talking to coaches at all different levels about what it takes to be recruited. So my story, I was a kid who I really had, I guess, no idea whatsoever about what the recruiting process looked like. So I grew up following college basketball, knowing the top 50 high school players every year. Yeah. I read the blue ribbon college basketball yearbook. Was like my Bible.
Yeah.
Loved college basketball. Used to read that thing. I'd compare the players' stats. I'd look at, well, you know, what am I going to average this year? And, you know, those kinds of things. So I knew everything about those high school guys, the top 50 from that blue ribbon college basketball yearbook. And then I'm following the game. And so in my area, I thought I was a pretty good player, and I got a chance to match up against lots of other guys that played Division I basketball. Mm-hmm. Eventually, that were in my graduating class, and I felt like I could hold my own, if not play better than all or most of them. And so, I had a very unrealistic expectation in terms of where I thought I could go. And so, here's my example for that. So I was being recruited by Kent State, and I believe this was the summer after my junior season. Yeah. So Kent calls me up, and they're like, hey, Mike, we want you to come down on an official visit, check things out. We're really interested. We'd like you to come down and be a part of it. And at this point, I had maybe three other schools that were showing like any interest at all. I mean, I'm talking like anything like a phone call. I mean, I got some letters, but as we all know, like letters,
yeah,
letters mean very, very little. So I had maybe three other schools. One of them was Cleveland State, where my dad was a professor. And so I had contact with the team through being down there with my dad and playing pickup games. And basically they were kind of telling me, well, you can come on and walk on. And if things work out, then we'll get you a scholarship after your first year. And then I was talking to St. Francis of Pennsylvania and the University of Akron. But I don't know how serious any of those places really were about. It wasn't like I was fielding offers and beating people off, you know, with a broom. It wasn't like that at all for me. So Kent calls me up and says, hey, we want you to come down for an official visit. And so I'm like, well, you know, you only get five of these. And, you know, I got to say,
it's only my junior year.
Yeah. I'm like, it's only my junior. I only finished my junior year. I'm going to have a great senior year. Like, Carolina's going to be calling me and I got to save a visit for Ohio State. So I told him I'm not interested in taking an official visit. I'll come down. I'll come down. I'll take an unofficial visit.
Okay.
And they're like, okay, sure. So I still remember I went down with my mom. We went, we met with the coaches, like, you know, in the coach's office, whatever. And then they couldn't pay for anything because it was an unofficial visit. So my mom and I left the coach's office and then we went to Wendy's. And I remember sitting with my mom, and, you know, talking about, well, what did you think of the coaches? And, you know, we're just having this conversation. We're eating our Wendy's. And then we went back and talked to them a little bit more and just kind of toured the facility and toured the campus. And then I went home. And then that was the last I heard from them. I never heard from them again until probably midway through my senior year. Nothing else was happening. Obviously, none of those big, you know, none of those big time schools, none of that materialized. So I'm like, well, all right, who showed an interest in me? I'm like, well, Kent wanted me at some point to come down for an official visit. So maybe I'll reach back out to them. So reach back out to them. I said, hey, I don't know if you're still interested in me. I'd be interested in coming down. You know, I'm interested if you still are. And they said, well, we still have some interest. We had a lot of scholarships. We had some kids that transferred. We're not sure whether or not we're going to have a spot for you, but we'll keep you in mind. I'm like, okay. So I'm not sure what that, what that means, what it doesn't mean. And then one of the assistants came out and watched me play in a game. This is, again, like the last 10 games of my senior year. The head coach, Jim McDonald, came to my final home game, which was against our biggest rival. And I had a pretty good game. And I could see on the video, I knew he was there. And I could see where he was sitting when I watched the video of this game. And the game went to double overtime. And by the time the game went to overtime, he was gone. So he wasn't there. And it turned out this is my last home game, biggest rival. And I ended up hitting about a 35'3" at the buzzer. So the score was tied at the buzzer.
To win it.
My last home game as a senior literally at the buzzer, the ball's in the air halfway to the basket at the buzzer. And of course, the coach from
Kent, not here.
He's not there to see this clutch shot. He had seen enough, apparently. Yeah. So at some point at the end of my senior year, they offered me a scholarship. I was the 7th scholarship freshman.
Wow, that's a big class.
In that class.
Yeah.
Clearly, I was the last. I mean, I was clearly the last guy. We had played against Lorraine Admiral King, which is actually, it no longer exists anymore. But at the time, they were ranked like 13th in the USA Today coaches poll in that time. And so my future teammate of mine played on that team, Harold Walton. So he had already signed with Kent. And then there was obviously 5 other kids that had signed before me. So I guess the point is I had no idea. My parents had no idea. My high school coach had never had anybody recruited at that level. So it wasn't like today where you could just
different
go
ball game,
and find,
right?
Yeah, you could go and find information. Like if it was today, I would have known that, look, Duke is not calling. North Carolina is not calling. You got to start investing your time in, if you think you're a Division I player, you better start investing your time with some of these mid-majors that are interested and demonstrate to them that you're interested.
Yeah. You would have had a U that you were working with and they would have been able to guide you too.
Absolutely. There would have been somebody, there would have been somebody in my circle that would have known and figured it out and would have got to me earlier and said, hey, this isn't realistic. What you have in your head as a high school junior is not realistic for you. And if I'd have known that, obviously I'd approach the initial visit with Kent a lot differently. And luckily for me, honestly, Aaron, it worked out about as well as I could have hoped. My head coach at Kent State was Jim McDonald, and he was a guy who was pretty conservative guy in some ways. And in a lot of ways, he was maybe a little bit forward thinking. I didn't think about that when I was playing for him, but he had a lot of analytics and stuff. Like we used to do like points per possession.
Really?
And he would track that. Yeah. And so we're talking, you know, this is late 80s, early 90s. And so he had some stuff that was ahead of its time. And yet a lot of the ways our program was kind of stuck back in the 50s and 60s. Cause my freshman year, our uniforms had belts. So I'm sitting on the bench in these short shorts that had a belt on it. And you're like, oh yeah, this is a little uncomfortable. I want to get in the game just so I can like move.
Crazy.
And then we ate steak for every pregame meal. And again, we're talking, I mean, it's not like this was 1960.
Nothing makes you light on your feet like a steak before it.
I mean, I was lucky in that for whatever reason, I could play on just about anything but pizza.
Yeah.
So I was okay. But, you know, again, from a scientific standpoint and understanding nutrition and everything, obviously steak isn't what you want to be eating, but we ate it every pregame meal.
Amazing.
So there was a lot of things like that, but Coach McDonald loved me. I was the kind of player that he really liked. I was hard-nosed. I was tough. I worked hard. I was a guy who was always in great shape. And so those are the things that he really valued. And because he valued the things that I was good at, it gave me an opportunity to play where had I gone somewhere else, there's a decent possibility. I mean, I feel confident in my abilities that I could have found a role, a niche in a lot of places, but I think he gave me probably more opportunity to prove what I could do than what I might've been able to get somewhere else. So I ended up having a real nice career as a freshman. I played sparingly, maybe.
How did you approach your, cause I think it's so different now. I honestly think it's a little bizarre how so much expectation is heaped on freshmen, because it didn't used to be like that. That was like, hey, get used to being a college player. You know, you never expect a guy that jumps from like JV to varsity to just be the star. And it's just, I mean, I know some of the guys are ready, but I'm curious just how you approached it and how you worked through that, because it was a process and you got there, but it was, you know, not an immediate impact, you know.
It's definitely totally different today. And I think part of that is when you think about social media, when you think about just the awareness of, you know, kids that have a better understanding of what they're getting into, again, because they're better educated about what it's going to look like when they get to school. Obviously, there's still an adjustment, and some kids are more ready for that adjustment than others. Mm. But I walked into it not really knowing. I mean, I had an idea of who was on the roster, so I knew who I was going to be competing against to be able to try to get minutes.
Yeah.
So when I went in as a freshman, they had a returning senior point guard who was a junior the year before, and then he was a senior my freshman year. And he was an all-league player, really good player. So I knew that spot wasn't open. Not going there. So I wasn't getting that spot. And then they had a returning two guard who was a year ahead of me, who played a decent amount as a freshman, not a ton, but got minutes. I mean, got meaningful minutes. And then we had the kid that I referenced earlier, who had been a player that I played against in high school, who's a really good player. He ended up being the MAC freshman of the year, averaged like 9 or 10 points a game, and had a really good freshman year. And so I started looking at that, and I'm like, look, unless something really strange happens, I'm probably not going to play that much my freshman year. And it was a very, very, very tough year, Aaron, I got to say. I mean, I love basketball as much as anybody. I mean, I love playing. The day the season ended, I'd be in the gym the next day just playing pickup basketball because I just love to play.
Yeah.
And so my freshman year, it was tough. It was the first time ever that there were days when practice would roll around and I'd be like, man, I just don't want to go. It's not fun, especially when you're not playing. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. So I roomed my freshman year with two other basketball players who were scholarship freshmen in my class. They both ended up leaving after their freshman year. One went to Malone and he became the all-time leading scorer at Malone. He scored like 2,200 points at Malone.
Jeez.
And if he would have stayed at Kent, he probably wouldn't have played very much as a sophomore, but he would have been a starter as a junior and a senior for sure. And he would have had a real good career, but he ended up going to Malone. And then my other roommate that freshman year ended up transferring out and not playing basketball. He just went to Ohio State as a regular student. But the three of us would sit in our dorm room. And so we'd be watching TV after lunch. You know, you go to class, we come home, we eat, you know, come back to the dorm, we'd eat lunch, and then we'd sit
steak down. Steak again.
Yeah, exactly. And so we'd watch TV. And I don't know if you remember the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Of course, yeah.
But the Dick Van Dyke Show was always on at 2:30 on old, which here in the Cleveland area, it was like old Channel 43.
We always had the Price is Right on.
Yeah, there you go. So it was like the UHF station, whatever.
Yeah.
So 2:30 or like 2:35, practice was at 3. So we'd usually leave the dorm, you know, whatever, 5-minute walk to practice. Mm-hmm. We'd usually leave the dorm about 2:35. And so it became where the Dick Van Dyke Show theme was like this PTSD thing. We'd hear that song, be like, oh God, it's time for
practice. I should have that queued up right now to see what it does to you.
But anyway, it's like you'd see me just like flinch.
Yeah.
So it was just interesting that it was the first time for me that basketball, like I don't ever remember a day of a high school basketball practice where I wasn't like, man, that was great. That was so much fun.
Yeah.
And college was just a lot tougher. We'd practice long hours, really intense. Coach McDonald was an old school, tough guy. Not tough in the sense of Bobby Knight, where he was screaming profanities at you. Not like that at all, but just much more subtle psychological stuff where you just knew that, man, I can't let down here. I've got to do this, or coach is going to say this to me, or he's going to get this, or I'm going to have to. He just had a way with working your mind over and just making it difficult. It was a challenge. And so that year for me, I felt like I adjusted pretty well on the floor. Like I felt like I held my own. I clearly understood where I fit in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
So you think about today's situation where a kid goes in and they're a freshman and they don't play as much as they thought they were going to. Like I didn't have anybody in my ear telling me, hey man, you're better than these guys that are playing ahead of you. Hey man, you got to go somewhere else. Hey man, this coach is, you know, sticking it to you. You should go play. You should get in the transfer portal and go somewhere else. It wasn't like that at all for me. There was never, even in the darkest days, there was never a thought from me of, hey, I'm going to transfer. Now, did I have thoughts of this is tough and man, it's not as fun as I hoped it was going to be? I absolutely had those thoughts, but I never had a thought of I'm going to leave and go somewhere else. So what I did during my freshman year is I said, all right, it doesn't look like I'm going to get major minutes. And I played a little bit more by the end of the season. At the beginning of the season, I was playing next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the season, I was getting 4 to 6 minutes in minutes that mattered, not just garbage time.
Yeah, check in.
And so that gave me a little bit of confidence heading into my sophomore year, where at the end of my freshman year, I just started looking at, okay, what do we have coming back? And what do I need to do to get on the floor? What is this team going to need me to do that's going to allow me to have a role with it? And anybody who played with me in high school would tell you that I was much more of an offensive player and defense was probably an afterthought. Not much different probably from most high school players who are big time players. For the most part, the offensive end of the floor is where your bread is buttered. And I was certainly no exception to that. I don't think anybody would have accused me of being a great defender in high school. And
they got to worry about you, not the other way around.
For sure. Absolutely. I'll just outscore you. In high school, it's just like, hey man, I'll just outscore you. Score as much as you want. I'm going to score more.
Yeah.
And then you get to college, you realize, hey, everybody's talented.
Yeah.
Everybody can do things offensively. And I started looking around. I said, look, our team the following year. So when I was a sophomore, we had 4 returning starters that were all really good players, that were all scorers, that had good offensive games. I'm like, coach doesn't need my offense. Now that doesn't mean I'm going to go out there and average 2 points a game, but he doesn't need me. I'm not going to be getting a volume number of shots. So I said, I got to become a defensive player. And I just basically changed my mindset and said, I'm going to become the best defender on this team. And look, I wasn't quick. I wasn't fast. I wasn't super strong. I played at 6'3", 175 pounds. But I just transferred the will kind of that I had as a young kid to work and get better. And I just said, I'm going to become the best defensive player that I possibly can. And was I perfect? No, but I learned the tricks of the trade. I learned how to get a forearm on the guy as he's driving to just bump him enough to slow him down, to get him down to my speed. I learned how to move my feet. I took a lot of charges. I got in passing lanes, and that got me on the floor.
Nice.
And so from my sophomore year through my senior year, I may have averaged a little bit less minutes, but I mean, my junior and senior year, I think I averaged I played 38 minutes a game. I mean, I was on the floor basically the whole game. And
well, you say you didn't score, but I saw on College Reference, you got to 1,000 points. So you
got to 1,000 points.
You're getting some buckets.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what I mean by not score is I was never the main. My junior and senior year, we had three guys that scored 1,000 points that came in my class.
Okay.
But scoring was never the thing in college. It wasn't like I was like, hey man, give me the ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm gonna go get us a bucket.
Get out of the
way.
I
was not that kind of player.
Yeah.
I was much more of a glue guy. I was much more of a shooter. I could get to the basket, a distributor. I played mostly two, but my senior year, the kid that I mentioned earlier, who was our point guard, he ended up getting hurt. He had a blood clot in his leg, so he missed his first 18 games. So I played 18 games at the point as a senior.
That's a challenge.
And yeah, so that was fun. I mean, I loved in the summertime, like summer basketball, I was always the point guard because I wanted the ball in my hands and I liked to pass. So I always found the game to be more fun when I was the point guard than when I was two, because I liked having the ball and I liked being able to move it around. So yeah, I mean, I scoring 1,000 points was something that if I look back on as far as individual things that I accomplished in college, there's probably nothing that I'm prouder of than the fact that I got to 1,000 points. And a quick story on that. So I had, when I was being recruited, I guess I should have told this as part of my recruiting story, but I had a school down in Atlanta, Oglethorpe University,
which is an
NAIA school, and beautiful old campus, like buildings that were built in like probably the late 1800s, just a beautiful campus. But I went down there and they took me into their gym, and it was like this teeny tiny little gym. I'm like, my high school gym's bigger than this. I'm like, I don't know if I want to go to college and play in a smaller gym than what I played in high school. That was a fun recruiting trip. They took me to the NCAA tournament at the Omni. I saw Oklahoma play when they had Mookie Blaylock.
Nice.
That was fun. And Louisville was down there, and I remember all the Louisville fans like in the subway as we were going back to the dorms, like chanting, "Let's go Cards." It was crazy. So that was a lot of fun. But I had an assistant coach down there, and I wish I remembered his name, but I don't. But I still have his face burned in my memory. And what he told me was, he goes, because at the time I was considering Oglethorpe. I was considering, obviously, I was hoping Kent was going to offer me a scholarship. And I told him that when I went down on the visit. I'm like, look, if Kent offers me a scholarship, I mean, I'm going Division I because I think I'm a Division I player. And he's like, you don't want to go to Kent, man. He goes, you know, you're going to go there and they're going to recruit right over you next year and you're never going to play. He goes, you can come down here and you could be a 1,000 point scorer for us.
Nice.
So when I got to 1,000, and it's funny, Aaron. So
send that letter, care of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So my last game, so I ended up with 1,006 points.
Perfect.
And my last game as a senior was in our tournament. Obviously, you don't want to lose, but there's a thought. We were like 9-17 or something. So there was certainly a thought that we could lose that last game. And I remember going in, I scored 17 in that game. So what did that mean? I needed 11 to get to 1,000, not knowing for sure whether that would be my last game.
Yeah.
And obviously I didn't go out gunning necessarily just to get that 1,000.
Yeah,
but that was important. We lost the game, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I did get my 1,000 points. And it's something, like I said, of all the individual things that I was able to accomplish, that's probably the one that I'm the most proud of, because it kind of speaks to sort of the longevity and just my resilience to kind of keep sticking with it. Because again, you look at the guys that I played certainly against, and I wasn't as fast as a lot of them.
Yeah.
I wasn't as quick as a lot of them. I wasn't as big as a lot of them. And I feel like, and this is kind of a lesson when we talk about what would you share with young players. I think it's one, when you go somewhere, whether you're talking about as a high school player, whether you're talking about as a college player, I think the one thing that I did really well is I tried to figure out not what I wanted, but I tried to figure out what my coach wanted, because my coach was the guy who decided whether or not I got on the floor or not. And I could have been stubborn. I could have said, look, I was a 22 points a game guy in high school, and you know, whatever, I could shoot the three and I could do this and that. And that's what I should be doing all the time. Instead, I said, look, I got to double down on something that maybe wasn't my strength, and I got to become a defender. And I think kids today too often, they don't look at, well, what does the coach see in me, or what does the coach want? And maybe I've got to do more of what the coach wants in order to, for me to get on the floor. And I think that's an important lesson for players of all levels to sort of take away.
Fill that role, huh? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hey, what do you remember about, I saw in there too, do you remember going to IU or Indiana in 89-90, playing at Assembly Hall? Tell me about that.
Okay, so I got a bunch of good stories from that trip. So yes. First thing is, we get into Indiana the night before. So we drive, I forget what day the game was in, but we usually got on the bus and bus out there the night before. So we bus out, we get into Indiana like around dinner time. Indiana's finishing up their practice, and then we're getting the floor after Indiana. So the first thing that you notice when you walk into the floor into Assembly Hall at that time is all the chairs are bolted to the floor.
Yes.
So they literally underneath.
No
the bench,
coincidence there.
They had right. They had these metal clamps that were in the floor, and then the chairs had like an old, like if you think of like a bike lock that ran through all the chairs and through these clamps. So obviously Bobby Knight couldn't pick up another chair and chuck it across the floor. And then Bob Knight was there, and I had never seen Bob Knight in person before. Uh-huh. And Bob Knight is a much, much bigger individual than I would have ever imagined seeing him on TV. I mean, he's like 6'4", maybe 6'5", just a big person. So seeing him in person, somebody that you'd seen on TV so often, and just seeing him there, and I didn't have any personal interaction with him other than just kind of seeing him from 10 or 12 feet away.
Right.
And he was just bigger than I remember. That's that's the overwhelming memory I have of Bobby Knight, is just that he was bigger and that, hey, the chairs are bolted to the floor. So those were sort of the two pregame things I noticed.
Yeah.
Then during the game, behind the baskets at Assembly Hall, they have all the banners.
Of course.
And while you're shooting, or while, I mean, I'm assuming it's going on all the time, but I noticed when I was shooting free throws, those banners go like this because of, I don't know if it's the air conditioning system or whatever, but the banners go side to side. So you're up there shooting free throws, and it's like, you know, you're looking at the baskets kind of moving. So I remember that. And then I don't remember if I told you guys this story when you guys were on, but at the time when we played Indiana, Lawrence Funderburk, who was actually an Ohio guy, that he transferred out of Indiana probably shortly after they played against us, but he was probably a top 10 recruit in the country.
Definitely.
Really a big time player. Yeah. And so we're playing this game, and this is in the first half at some point, and there's a timeout. And so Lawrence Funderburk and I are crossing. I'm going to my bench this way, and he's coming to his bench across this way. And he stops, and he goes up, and he grabs me like this. And he goes, and then he just keeps walking to the bench. And I'm like,
that's the weirdest thing.
I turn around, I was like, what just happened?
Oh my
and then
gosh.
At some point later in the game, he did it again. And I was like, dude, what are you doing? And he just kind of looked at me. He's like, so after the game,
so
we're
weird.
In the locker room, and we it was a close game, by the way. We lost, I think, by maybe, I don't know, seven,
that's
eight,
a good
somewhere
show.
There.
Yeah, that was a good team.
Yeah. And we were in the right. They had Greg Graham and Eric Anderson, and they were good. And I get in the locker room after the game, and one of my teammates goes, hey man, you know, you got fuzz from your towel all over your face. Cause I had like a scruffy, you know, whatever. College
oh yeah.
Beard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was all this white fuzz. I went in the bathroom, like there's all this white fuzz all over
oh,
my face.
Oh my God.
So Funderburk was going by. He was plucking fuzz off of my face.
He's trying to help you out. He wants you on TV.
He was trying to intimidate me and help me out all at once.
I love
it. So yeah, that was a fun experience. That was a game. My sophomore year, that was probably our best team, was my sophomore year. I think we went 21-9. We split with Ball State, who ended up going to – they beat Louisville that year in the NCAA tournament. I think they lost to the the Larry Johnson, Stacey Augmon, UNLV team, and they didn't get killed. It was a close game. Yeah. Ball State was really good. So we split with them during the regular season. We had a couple nice wins during the regular season. We really thought that if we could get to the final of the MAC tournament, and even if we lost to Ball State, we thought we might be able to get an at-large bid. And then we played probably our worst game of the season, the first round of the MAC tournament, got upset. And, you know, you just
didn't get the at-large. Huh?
Yeah, you didn't get the, you know, you didn't get to go. We went to the NIT my first 2 years. My first year, we lost to Ball State in the MAC tournament championship by one. You know, you're a freshman, you're not playing very much. You're like, yeah, we'll get another
every
opportunity.
Year we're gonna go,
yeah, we're going to be right here. We'll get another chance. Yeah. And hopefully I'll be playing the next time we get a chance. Yeah. Then the next year we blow it by playing a bad game. And then my last 2 years, we had good talent, but we didn't have any size. And my coach, we started out my junior year playing three guards. And so I was playing at 6'3", 175. I was playing Division I small forward, which was fine. So I was getting beat up by, I remember we played Cincinnati. And they had LaVertus Robinson, who was about 6'7", like 240. And so I'm guarding him. I've never felt so overwhelmed on a basketball floor as we were by – I think Cincinnati got out to us. And we weren't this bad, but Cincinnati got out to like a 27-4 lead on us in that game. And I've never felt more helpless on a basketball floor than I did in that game. But anyway, we were actually – with that lineup, we were actually playing well because it got our best kids on the floor. And we were 7-4 in our non-conference schedule. And then – coach didn't like it. We were shooting too many threes. We were turning the ball over. And so
you weren't shooting enough threes.
Yeah, we were right. Exactly. We were playing up tempo and he didn't really like that particular style. So he ended up going back and shifting to what we had always done when we went back into league play. And then
he needed to look at that points per possession in that case.
I know. Well, you look at the game has changed.
Yeah.
And like I look at the number of threes that I took. And I compare it to how many I would take if I was playing in the
you
game
still took
today.
quite a few though, so you knew that it was a weapon.
But it's still it just was nothing.
No.
You know, the game was nothing like what it is. It wasn't as open. Like I ran if I was involved in as an offensive player on our team, if I was involved in five pick and rolls my entire career, that might be high.
Yeah.
In all honesty. I mean, that wasn't part of the game.
Yep.
Was not part of what we did. It wasn't part of what most teams did. And then the three was not the weapon that it is today. I mean, obviously, guys shot it. I shot it. But there was none of this volume hunting of threes. There was no understanding of, hey, look, the math says three is better than two. I mean, even the NBA didn't figure that out until 6-7 years ago. So at the college level, it just wasn't the way it was played. And so part of me says, I wonder what it would be like to play – in today's game. And obviously you can't go back and retrofit it, but it was a different game than when I played for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's fast forward a bit. Cause I want to get into the Head Start basketball.
Sure.
And talk about, some of the training you do. Cause the word trainer or even like running camps has become like the Instagram influencer of the basketball universe, but you've been doing it for a long time. So I'd like to know just what got you into that. And, where'd you get the idea then for it?
Sure. Great question. So I started out and I had a friend who, his name was Scott Roth, and he graduated from a high school near me about 7 years before me. And I actually met Scott. Scott played in the NBA, played with the Utah Jazz. He played with the Spurs. He was part of the expansion draft and got drafted by the Timberwolves when they came into the league. So he played on the inaugural Minnesota Timberwolves team. And he probably played all told like 3.5 seasons in the NBA, never played much, was always the 11th or 12th man, but he was an NBA player. And then he had a really good career in Europe. And now he's actually coaching. He just got he coached with Don Nelson in the NBA. He's been with like four or five different franchises. And he just took over there's an expansion team in the NBL, which is the top league in Australia. Nice. And he's the head coach of this new expansion team in Australia. So he's been all over the world. He was the head coach at one time for the Dominican Republic's national team. So this guy's been everywhere. But anyway, he and I met one day when I had watched him because he was a local high school player. And so I grew up going to games at my high school and they were a rival. And so I had seen him play when he was in high school. And then he ended up going to the University of Wisconsin. And one day when I was probably – I don't know. I was maybe 15, 16, 17 years old. I can't remember exactly. And he had just become a pro. Mm. And so I was out at the courts in my local area, and this is in the middle of summer, so it's like 90 degrees.
Yeah.
I'm out there on the court by myself, and I'm shooting. And Scott drives up in this white Mercedes, and he pulls into this gravel parking lot, his Mercedes. He gets out, and he starts shooting. Then he walks down to me. He's like, "Hey, how you doing?" I'm like, "Hey, how you doing?" I knew, you know, I knew who he was. He obviously had no idea who I was. And he's like, "Hey, I need somebody. I'm trying to get in shape for my season. I need somebody that'll play one-on-one full court with me, and that can, and that can run. You think you can do it?" I'm like, "Absolutely."
You found your man.
I'm like, "If you want somebody who can run all day, like 16-year-old Mike,
got that,
could run all day." I'm like, "I may not be able to do anything else with you, but I can do that." So we ended up playing one-on-one full court on these outdoor courts.
Jeez.
That day, 90 degrees, like on a July
Are you
day.
Icing your knees right now as we speak?
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. And from that, he and I developed a friendship, and we kind of became workout partners and friends, and you know, really got to know each other. And it probably for the next, I don't know, all the way through my college years, we played together on some summer league teams and
That's
worked
awesome.
Out together. And so it was just, it was one of those things that it was obviously
a bit of serendipity right there, right?
Yeah. I mean, probably better for my development than for his. I mean, whatever I contributed to his career, but I mean, he contributed a ton to mine. But anyway, at some point during that period, while I was probably I must've been in college, Scott had a basketball camp and he ran that basketball camp at the high school that I went to. And he probably had 70 or 80 kids at this basketball camp. And the camp ended and I was working at it. The camp ended and I had this thought. I'm like, man, how many people even really know who Scott Roth is? Because from this area, you know, he hadn't played high school basketball here for like, at that point, probably 10 years.
Right.
He went to the University of Wisconsin. Now he's playing kind of overseas, or he's in the NBA.
Yeah,
but he's not really playing that much. It's not like his name was instantly recognizable by parents of fifth graders in my community. So at that point, I'm like, man, I played here only 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I should really think about trying to start something on my own. I loved working with kids. I'd always loved kids when I was, you know, from the time I was younger. And so I thought, well, why don't I give this a shot? So when I graduated from college, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I got a business degree and I ended up looking around and going, both my parents had been teachers. So when I interviewed for jobs, I'd go to these job interviews and they'd be like, "All right, we'll hire you." And I started saying, "Wait, you want me to put on a suit and go to work in July?" I'm like, "Are you serious? Like I've never seen anybody do that in my life. Like all summer long, my parents are around." So as I went in those interviews, I started thinking, well, I got to go back to school. So I ended up going back to school to get my teaching certificate. So that first summer I worked at some other camps and did some stuff, but I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to start a camp. So this is now not the first summer after I graduated from Kent, but the second summer, I thought, let me put these camps together. And I was going to do one at each one of the elementary schools in my hometown. At the time we had 7 elementary schools.
Oh, wow.
So I ended up,
ambitious.
Yeah. So I ended up running 7 camps because the idea was I wanted kids to be able to, this tells you how different the times were. I wanted kids to be able to get on their bike or walk.
I like it.
To a neighborhood school, as opposed to having to get in a car and have mom or dad drive them to the high school, they could just hop on their bike.
Never happened.
Camp. Yeah. Now, like now that idea, people would be like, "Well, you're an idiot."
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the time it made sense. So I ended up running like 7 camps and I had, you know, one or two of the schools, like each of those elementary schools only had 2 hoops. So there was a limit to how many kids you could have. So I think the most kids I had for any of those first initial camps was maybe like 22 and the low was maybe like 8. So I ran these different camps. I think the first year I ended up with whatever, 80 kids maybe that came over the course of those 7 weeks. And it was a blast. I mean, I had so much fun.
That's cool.
It was me and my friends, you know, so it was just me and my buddies at the time running these camps. And so, you know, I think back to I'll tell you about some of the dumb stuff when we first started the camps. So anyway, it was a blast and we did it. And then the following year, I ended up talking to the high school coach and we kind of worked it out and he ended up allowing me to use both the high school and the junior high. So I ended up cutting it down. I think I went to like a morning and an afternoon session for 2 different weeks. So I ended up really running 4 camps instead of 7. And for a long time, that's how it was. And then eventually I got my teaching job and it sort of became my summer job.
It's your side, every teacher's got to have a side gig, right?
Absolutely. And it was great. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like it was what that did for me. And eventually for my family in terms of just having extra spending money and being able to go on vacation and renovate the house and all that stuff. It was great. But then part of me looks at it and says, man, I really missed. I was kind of like one of the first actors sort of on the scene.
Yeah.
But I never took it. And if I had it to do over again back in whatever, 1994, 95, 96, when I was first starting out, I should have really tried to take it and expand it to different areas and kind of corner the market, so to speak. But it was never, that's just never what it was for me. It was kind of, I was at my hometown. I ended up adding a week like at the school where I taught. And so it was just a really good summer job for me. I never thought of it as something that I could do, not even full time, but I just never really thought about, hey, I should expand this. And then that wave kind of ended up passing me by, and I'm still doing it now. And I'm in a few more communities, and it's still a summer job. It's never been full time for me. And now it's probably past the point where that's even feasible, but I love what I do. I love doing it. And it was a lot of fun. And I think back to those early years and I mean, some of the stuff we do. So here's an example.
Now keep in mind
that like my friends and I are like 23 years old.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've been to basketball camps. We know what's fun. We know what's not. So we used to play, you know, so we would have these knockout contests and, you know, you play knockout and
classic.
You get a winner at each. Yeah. You get a winner at each basket and then you bring them in, you play this, you know, so you'd have the championship, the kids win a basketball card, whatever. But we'd be like, hey, there isn't any parents here today. There's nobody watching. Let's get some continuous knockout going. So we'd be like, okay, right, we got six baskets. All right, everybody go to your basket and then you play knockout. And then if you lose at this basket, you just move to the next basket. Yep. And so we play. And then my buddies and I, we'd go sit in the bleachers and just watch them play for like a half hour. And then after 30 minutes, we'd get up and we'd be like, all right, who won? And then they'd all look at, you know, you got all these like 8, 9, 10-year-olds looking at us like, you know, looking What's at happening? Us like we're crazy. Yeah. And we used to, when kids would get out, we'd do stuff like we'd make them go get a water bottle and carry it around the gym like a victory torch. Or we'd say, hey, you got to go, you know, if you get knocked out, you got to go sit like under the chair of that coach over there. Or you got to go, you know, do like just all this stuff that I look at now and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we did all those. You didn't know any better. Yeah. And again, it was a different era.
Yeah.
Like you could joke around with kids way more back then.
Well, you guys are kids too. So
We were kids too, but people were still paying us.
Yeah. That's nice.
People were still paying us. And now you look back on it, you're like, I probably wasn't providing, but again, every kid that left our camp always had fun.
I was going to say, that sounds like fun to me. If I was that same 8, 9, 10-year-old, I'd be doing just fine for myself.
No doubt about that. And so they left it and had fun. And then obviously over time it's evolved and we've kind of figured out a formula that works. And we've always had basketball cards being a part of it and giving those away. And we've been selling them 2 for a quarter for 30 years. This is the first year I haven't been able to sell cards, Aaron, because I can't find anything cheap. There's nothing. I mean, I can't find, usually I can find cards and I'll buy them like 4 or 5 cents a card, like within the last like 3 years, typically. And this year there's nothing out there. They're so expensive.
It's out of control. You might as well start making your own non-fungible tokens and giving those to kids.
It's absolutely crazy. So anyway, we've kind of figured out a formula with camp that works, that's fun. We divide it up with half learning with stations and having the kids go through that. And we do some shooting contests at the end of every station. And then the second half of the camp, we play some half court games and have some contests. And you build in rest where the kids don't really know they're resting. So they're watching a free throw championship or they're doing this or that. And it just ends up being a lot of fun. And one of the things that we've said, and I've said it probably for the last 15 years is our goals. We always have 3 goals. So we say, we want you to have fun. We want you to learn some about the game. And when you leave, we want you to be inspired to play more basketball. And so I tell that to the kids. And I don't know if it always resonates with them, but I always say that to the parents, both on the first day and at the last day when we do our awards. Like, look, this is what we're trying to accomplish, and hopefully we're able to do that. And I think people appreciate it because the camp world, it's changed so much in that everything now is elite. Everybody wants to play in a league or play on a team, and you just don't have kind of the fundamental type camps that were so prevalent when I was a kid. And so our camp, it's interesting. I would say overall, like the level of play in our camp is probably lower than it used to be. But I think there's probably even a higher level of fun that the kids get out of it and that I get out of it, because there just isn't these experiences out there, because everybody's always, it goes back to what we talked about off the top. Structured. Everybody's always playing. Yeah. Everybody's always structured. And so to be able to play in kind of an unstructured environment where somebody's not telling you what to do, to me, even if you're eight, like that's a valuable piece of what it takes to develop a love for the game. And a love for the game might translate into you becoming a varsity player, or it might just translate to you want to go out and take some shots and pretend to be Dr. J on your driveway the way I did when I was a kid.
That's right.
And to me, that's really what it's all about.
For sure. For sure. Well, I've got some quick hitters as we wrap up. I want to thank you for coming on tonight.
Absolutely.
I want to shout out to the Hoopheads podcast, because I've been listening to it. They've got a mentorship program for coaches too, which I think is so cool. I'm on the email chain where I haven't sent anything in, but I love reading the questions you pose to coaches. And then
yeah, you gotta get in there.
I will. Sure, yeah. Man. And then they come back though with really just thoughtful answers. And on top of that, you've got this podcast network that you've developed, which I think is just fascinating with all the NBA. You've got the Thrive with Trevor Huffman and Beyond the Ball. You've got team specific things for the Spurs and the Hoops and the Wizards. And so there's just a lot going on. And I think the passion for the game of basketball really comes through. So I appreciate all that you're doing and taking some time tonight to talk to us.
Absolutely. Thanks for the kind words. Yeah, we've done a lot of stuff with the podcast. It's been really a passion project, something that we started now a little over 3 years ago. Had it on my to-do list for probably a year and a half before we finally pulled the trigger and kind of figured out how to do this whole thing from a technology standpoint. Mm. And then the biggest thing that happened for us, Aaron, is we got some good people on right out of the gate. And then those good people opened up their network to us and started connecting us and said, hey, I had a good experience with these guys. You should have this person on. Here, right. Let me connect you with them. And then once that happened, it just sort of fed on itself.
I believe it.
And it became easier. You know, it becomes easier when you have a platform. It becomes easier to ask people, hey, do you want to jump on our podcast and tell us a little bit about what you're doing? Tell us about your program. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your business. Tell us about the way that you came up in the game, and share that with our audience of coaches and fans and players and parents and people who are listening to the show. And it's been so interesting to be able to talk to the people that we've been able to talk to. And I never would have guessed that we'd have been able to talk to Jay Billis, or we've been able to get Paul Biancardi, or we had Mark Price, former Cleveland Cavalier Mark Price. And then like those famous people are great to talk to. But then it's also like the random high school coach from the state of Arkansas, or the random guy that's a Division IV coach in the state of Ohio, or the women's coach at whatever, this particular school. It's just those are the people that I think you learn from, because what you find is that there's so many great coaches out there at every level that you can learn from. It doesn't matter. We've had NBA assistant coaches on that we've learned a ton from, and we've had AAU coaches on that we've learned a ton from, and we've had high school JV coaches on that we've learned something from. And it's just, everybody has something to share. And if your mind is open, you can always take something away. And that's the way we look at it, is we're learning something every time we have a guest. And we hope our audience does the same thing. It's been a joyride beyond belief.
You definitely do. And I think that honestly, sometimes, you know, part of what we do is like the tales from the bench, because sometimes this, the perspectives of different people, you know, give you different windows into the world of basketball.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, when you get to the higher levels, you might not need to coach as much, because you got a lot more talent. It's more about managing egos and running a program and all kinds of other skills, but not necessarily the X's and O's. If you got, you know, Kevin Durant and Kyrie and James Harden,
you know,
take a couple of them out, and it gets a little bit harder. So we'll see how good.
Things are a lot different for Steve Nash.
Yeah, he's going to have to turn on that coaching for the next game, or maybe suit up. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I'm expecting him to rip off his warm up anytime. Be like, hey, man, I got this.
He looks like he's still good.
He does, doesn't he? He does. He looks real good. Like he could get out there for sure.
I got some quick hitters for you as we wrap up. Coolest arena you played in besides the MAC?
It's not even close. The Roundhouse, University of Tennessee, Chattanooga.
Nice. Okay.
There's nothing that.
What about it?
So it felt like the second deck of that arena feels like it's almost hanging over the court.
And oh, wow. Okay.
It was just one of those places where you felt like the entire crowd was right on top of you. It's just a really cool building. The way it's set up is really cool. I mean, that's one that when I saw your question, I knew the answer. People have asked me that question before.
Yeah.
And I mean, my answer, there's no hesitation whatsoever. That is by far the coolest arena that we played in. It's not even close.
I think maybe think more about that when they're designing these new stadiums. Like, how can we make it crazier for the opposing players rather than the most beneficial?
I mean, it's just like the aesthetics, you know. Yeah. I think about like here in the state of Ohio. So Ohio State, when I was a kid growing up, played in St. John Arena.
Yeah.
And St. John Arena had sort of that same feel, like the upper deck kind of hangs over. Yeah. And the fans are right on top of you. And now they play in the Schottenstein Center, which is a beautiful arena. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have nearly the same atmosphere. Like, I don't walk into Schottenstein and say, man, Whoa. This is Ohio State.
Yeah.
I walk into St. John Arena and you can just feel Ohio State basketball dripping off of that place.
Definitely.
And you lose something when you build in the luxury suites and you put, you know, and you start doing all those things. It just doesn't have the same feel. Like, you think about, is Duke ever going to get rid of Cameron Indoor? I doubt it.
I hope not.
If they did, could Duke build a 20,000 seat arena and fill it and make a lot more money?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you'd lose what makes that place special.
Yeah, for sure. All right. This might be the same answer then, but craziest opposing fans.
All right. So that one's not the same because we only played at Tennessee Chattanooga. We played in a tournament. And I'm going to be honest with you. I don't even remember if we played Tennessee Chattanooga in that tournament.
There.
Like, we were there.
What is this place?
We played in their tournament. And I, to be honest, I don't know 100% for sure if we played Tennessee Chattanooga or we just played two other opponents in that arena. But the arena was great. So opposing fans that were the most difficult. So there's two games to me that stand out. When I was a sophomore, we played at Ball State. Okay. And Ball State in my junior year, they had a brand new arena. Mm-hmm. So in the course of my career, they built a brand new arena.
Oh, wow.
The new arena seats like 15,000. It's beautiful. And prior to that, they played in like this little, it was almost like a high school gym where literally the old wooden bleachers,
roll them out.
Yeah. The fans are sitting like in that first row, which literally means they're like 2 feet from the court.
Yeah.
And I remember we came out for, and again, when I was a sophomore, they were one in the league. We were two in the league. So we were the two, we were the two top teams in the league. So when we went there, and I know we beat them at home that year. I can't remember if we beat them first or they beat us first on their home floor. But when we were on their home floor, we came out for warmups, and the fans were literally like, they were right there. They were screaming. And my roommate, I'll leave his name out of it, but he came flying out, and he was the lead guy in the warmup. And he went up for his first layup and he shot the layup and it did not hit the rim. He crammed it off the backboard and it went flying off. And I mean, they were already crazy.
Oh, no.
And then the rest of the warm-up, they were just screaming at him the whole game.
Gosh.
Nice layup, you know, and just this whole thing. And so that whole game, they were right on top of us. Like I said, that was probably our biggest rival during my first 2 years.
Amazing.
Ball State was our biggest rival. So they were right there. And then we also played, and this was a non-league game, we played at Duquesne.
Yeah.
And Duquesne, what I remember about that game, we went to overtime in that game. And I had a pretty good game, but we lost. And Gannon Baker actually was playing for Duquesne at the time. I was a junior, I think, and Gannon Baker was a freshman. He played some in that game, and then he ended up transferring. But anyway, their fans, their student section was directly behind our bench.
Oh no.
And so, I mean, literally, like, you know, like, there's our bench and the student section is like, the, you know, they can reach out and like grab the back of your head. And so it wasn't a giant crowd, but it was just, you know, whatever. There was 200 students that were sitting right behind us.
That's all you need, right?
Yeah. That were just screaming stuff. And so this is kind of a funny story. I remember our assistant coach, you remember the show What's Happening?
Of course. Yeah.
All right. So our assistant coach, they started calling him Rerun.
Oh my God.
So they just kept screaming the whole game. They'd have this chant. They'd be going, Rerun. Like every time he would stand up to say something, they'd be going rerun. You're just like, oh my God.
He loved
like
that.
What's going on? Yeah. So, I mean, among other things, yeah, that they were yelling, but that was definitely one that I remember. So those are probably the two wildest crowds that I remember, again, just because of specific incidents or specific things that they were doing that I remember as a player.
Yeah. Love it. All right. Most impressive opponent, a specific player who impressed you.
That one's pretty easy for me too. Dave Jamerson, who played at OU.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up getting drafted by the Houston Rockets. He was like the 14th pick in the draft.
Nice.
He had some knee issues when he was at OU. He blew out his knee, I think, after his sophomore year. And then when he got to the NBA, he had knee problems.
Yeah, didn't
and
hold
he
up.
Never signed a second contract. He's a guy who, if he would have stayed healthy, and I think about like today's game, I've never, ever, Aaron, seen anybody shoot the ball in person the way this guy shot the ball.
Really?
So my sophomore year, which was his senior year, he averaged like 31 a game.
Wow.
And they played at our place, and he had 52. He had 11 threes. And I swear to you that he did not take a shot inside of 18 feet. I don't think he shot a layup the whole game. And I can honestly tell you that I haven't watched that film in a long, long time. But at the time when I went back and watched that video, like, I don't know that I could have played much. And I was on most of those 52 he gave to me. I mean, you know, 48 of those.
I thought maybe you were going to shout out your roommate again.
No. This was all, those 52 were all for me. But I can honestly say that, like, I was right there.
Yeah.
I was right there. And he just shot it in my face over and over and over again. And he was the guy who, in that era, there wasn't many guys shooting it from deep.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the threes that were being taken in that era, you were right at the line.
Right. Rick Pitino style, right on the line.
And Jamerson was not he could shoot it from anywhere. He had range out to, you know, 25, 26 feet, which at that time, nobody was really shooting the ball out there. And I've never played in a game against a guy who played better than he played in that game. And so he graduated when I was a sophomore. So I really only played against him when I was playing a lot. I really only played against him twice, but by far.
That's good.
By far the most difficult guy to cover. And then we had a guy, I'll tell you this story, quick story about Jamerson, funny story. So we had a guy come on our podcast who is the head coach of a high school here in the Cleveland area in Ohio at Archbishop Hoban, which is actually in Akron. And his name's TK Griffin. He came on and he said, cause he grew up in the same town where Jamerson grew up. And he said that he knew a guy that he was sort of friends with named Steve Barnes, who also played at OU. And at one point Barnes told him the story that Barnes said he walked into the gym and Jamerson was in there like getting his shooting workout up. And Barnes said he sat there and watched him. This was maybe when Barnes was a freshman and Jamerson was, let's say, a junior.
Mm-hmm.
And Barnes is watching him for a minute or two. And, you know, he's just banging in shot after shot after shot after shot. And he takes a quick break and Barnes walks over to him and says, "Dave, man, that was incredible. You know, I want to be able to shoot like you. What can I do to be able to shoot like you?" And he said, Jamerson turned to him and goes, "You're a million shots behind, Dave. You're a million shots behind."
Oh my God.
And you know, you're like, if anything sums up like basketball and what makes it great, like to me, that's what makes it great is like Dave Jamerson wasn't great because he was some unbelievable physical talent. Not that he didn't have physical tools. Sure. Obviously he did, but he was great because he was there sweating in the gym and he put up a million more shots than anybody else did. And that's why he was so good. And I love that line. I wish I was still 17.
Yeah.
So I could use that for real on people and not just tell the story.
A million shots behind.
Absolutely.
All right. Last one. One word to describe college basketball in the early 90s.
Man, one word. That's a tough one. I mean, for me, it still has to come down to it has to. I go back and forth. There's two.
Okay.
I'm going to go with one.
Okay.
So my one is challenging.
All
right. It was challenging. And And by challenging, I think it goes back to what we talked about a few minutes ago when you start talking about what do you try to do for kids as a coach? And you try to, as you said, put it just out of their reach. And I felt like college basketball for me, not that it was just out of my reach, but I felt like I had to, in order to compete at the level I played at, I felt like I had to put everything that I had out there in order to have success. If I had been at 94%, I don't think I could have accomplished what I was able to accomplish. Yeah. And so I found it every night that I went out there, both in practice, like I talked about, man, practice was challenging every day. I mean, I think about the amount of time that we spent like preseason, you know, we'd be going 3.5 hours day before a game. You know, there was no load management at the time. Like there was no like,
You're playing one-on-one full court on the concrete.
Exactly. Like I might be wearing these guys out. No. I got things I gotta get in as a coach and teach. And so practice was a challenge. Playing in games, looking at some of the guys that I was able to play against and the teams we were able to play against, and just all the things that go along with being a college basketball player, it was challenging. And then my secondary word was fun. I mean, the games are fun. The practices are challenging. The pushing yourself against really good players is challenging. But ultimately, the games have to be fun. Why are you playing them? Don't get me wrong. The practices were not fun. Yeah. Oftentimes, they were not fun at all. But getting out there and getting able to compete and challenge yourself—that's fun. And that's what I really enjoyed, is the opportunity to prove myself and to test myself against some really, really good players.
I love it, man. Well, I'm gonna get you out of here. I appreciate the time tonight.
Absolutely, Aaron. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to come on with you guys. It was a lot of fun. Oftentimes I get to tell these stories intermixed as I'm talking to my guests. So to be able to just kind of stream of consciousness going,
it's great.
Share my own stories, it was a lot of fun.
We're going to make you come back again.
Let's do it, man. I'm ready. All right, cool.
Thank you for listening to the 19.9 Podcast. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you do. And while you're at it, leave us a rating or review. 5 stars only, like the basketball camp. We also have links to all of 19.9 social media so you never miss a release. Until next time.